This message is part of the educational ministry of Columbia International University. We've been preparing world Christians to know Him and to make Him known since 1923.
This morning we'll be looking at a couple passages, one of which will probably be very familiar with it for you, Matthew 28, 19 and 20. Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you, and behold, I am with you always to the end of the age. I'm not a very good preacher, but they say I'm a good storyteller. So I'm just going to tell you some stories. And the first story comes after Jesus has spoken these words, and He has cast this vision to His disciples to go to all the nations. It was impossible for them to have even processed what those words could have meant, especially in light of the crucifixion of Christ, and even with the resurrection of Christ. They didn't fully understand. They didn't have the Holy Spirit indwelling them yet. And so they couldn't fully understand His words. After this, Jesus ascended. Then came Pentecost. And the Holy Spirit came. And there was this massive revival. And there was this moment of excitement, where the nations who had come together and have congregated in Jerusalem all of a sudden have come into an awareness of who Jesus is, and the church was growing day by day. And then comes the persecution where Stephen is killed. And this undoubtedly caused confusion, because here the church was dwelling with the power of the Holy Spirit, and they were seeing how people were being reached in Jerusalem, and they could see how this movement was growing, and all of a sudden there's a persecution. And it said, and there arose on that great day, I'm in Acts 8, verse 1, it says, and there arose on that day a great persecution against the church in Jerusalem, and they were all scattered throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria, except for the apostles. And going down to verse 4, and now those who were scattered went about preaching the word. Now what's interesting, if we take these two verses that follow one right after the other, what we see is the persecution comes on the church, and they're scattered because they're afraid, because they're just trying to stay alive, because they're confused. And you know, when all the apostles stay in Jerusalem, you've got to think that the leadership was making a decision saying, we can make this, we can survive this persecution. And they're probably sitting there going, I can't believe they're all fleeing. They're all going, and they're going out all over the place and staying here at the center of worship, at the center of religious life. And they must have been disappointed until they realized what it said, now those who were scattered went about preaching the word. Now what's most interesting is that the word spread through the Roman Empire and outside of the Roman Empire, not because of what the apostles did in Jerusalem, but because of what the persecuted, regular, scared church members did as they went. Because even though they were scared, they were faithful to the Lord. And that gives me great courage. Because I'm not a preacher. I'm sure not an apostle. I'm just a regular church guy. But I know what I can do, and I can share the hope that's in me. And as I go and share the word, I see the Holy Spirit working. And I see myself working in the tradition of the early church, where regular church members, not the clergy, not people with all kinds of advanced degrees, regular people like me get to be at the forefront of the Great Commission. And so this morning, what I want to do is I just want to tell you my story. And then hopefully as I tell my story, you get to hear my heart. And my hope is that you would be encouraged, that someone like me, if God can use someone like me, just a regular guy, that he can use someone like you. You probably think, you're just a regular person. And that's great, because that's the kind of faithful people that God is looking for. I grew up in Mexico. My parents were missionaries. My parents served for 38 years with the International Mission Board. My mother is originally from Costa Rica. Her father was a pioneer pastor in Costa Rica. And so I have great heritage, and I thank the Lord for that and for the blessing that comes from coming from a home that where the gospel was known and where my parents were able to model ministry and model Christian love and model a Christian home for me. When I graduated from high school in Mexico City, I went up to Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., and graduated there with a degree in international economics. And I got a job graduating from Georgetown with Procter & Gamble. And I interviewed with all these New York banks when my senior year, and then got an interview with P&G in the Caribbean, living in Puerto Rico. And they flew me down to the Caribbean, and I interviewed, and then they said, you know, you've got the long weekend here. You know, your hotel's right on the beach. You can hang out there for the weekend before you fly back. And I thought, okay, so cold, snowy New York or the Caribbean island, which do I pick? And so obviously I went to live in the Caribbean because of the beaches. And that was really exciting as a 22-year-old, recent college graduate. And that excitement lasted for about 6 months. And then I got what they call island fever. I just wanted off that island. It was tiny, it was insular. I mean, that's what insular means, right? Island. It was so inward looking, and I just wanted to go home. And I went to my boss, and I asked for a transfer to Mexico, which is where my parents were still living, because I wanted to go home. And my boss said, well, we don't give international transfers to junior people like you. And I persisted, and eventually, She gave me a business. It was called Downey, the fabric softener, in the Caribbean, and was losing a bunch of money. And she said, if you can turn this business around that's losing 17% margin, I'll send you back to Mexico. What she was saying was, forget it, I'm never going to send you. And her tone of voice was probably a lot less friendly than I just used. But I didn't hear it that way. I took it as a challenge. And so I worked with that sales team and with the production people and with everyone else in the company, and we turned that business around, and I got my transfer back to Mexico. And so in Mexico, I became known somewhat as a turnaround guy. So they kept giving me money-losing businesses, and I'd turn them around. And then to give me bigger business, I turned that business around. Eventually, they gave me the toilet soap category, which was $120 million in sales and was losing millions and millions of dollars and was a big drain for the company. And we turned that around to make it the second biggest profit contributor for Procter & Gamble. So I was seeing great success. And when Citibank decided to enter into the Mexican market, they needed a turnaround guy because they were buying a failed Mexican bank. And they needed someone who knew U.S. corporate culture, who knew turnarounds, who knew branding and marketing, and P&G's famous for that. And so they tapped me, and I was really young. I was 28 years old, and they put me into an extremely senior position, over $20 billion of assets, 300 branches. And they asked me to turn around the core bank, and I did that. And I did that with a team. It wasn't something that I did by myself, but God blessed me in that. But in the midst of all of this business success, I had learned from my dad that our life was not about being religious here on the weekend, and the rest of the week you're just a hard-nosed business guy. But rather, I had learned how to integrate my faith into what I did. And so when I was at P&G, I would I'd have early morning prayer meetings with some other believers. We started praying for a movement there in the workplace where we were. And we started to do Bible studies over lunchtime and after work. And you know, after a while, some of my coworkers started to come to Christ. And so that started to grow, and they started to bring some of their friends. And we saw God move. And the way that God moved in the midst of where I worked was amazing, was so encouraging. And there came a point where there were enough of us, and we needed to be able to take them to church. And there weren't any churches near where our office was. And you know, we were in a professional group of people, you know, upper class neighborhood in Mexico City, and most of the churches in Mexico were on the other side of town, really catered toward lesser educated people, more like the laborer type people you see here. And it was as big of a cultural leap for these new believers to go to a one of those churches as it would be for most of you to go to one of the Hispanic churches down the road. And so we realized we needed a church that really address the culture and the context of all of these new believers that we're seeing. And so we started a church in Western Mexico City at the Sheraton Hotel, and it very quickly grew to several hundred people, mostly lost people who came to hear the gospel for, you know, not really for the first time, but really to hear it in a relevant manner to them for the first time. And lots of people got saved. And so as I worked in everyone would consider a secular workplace, really being trained up by the Lord in how to do business and, you know, having great managers, I also was getting some practice in how to integrate my faith walk into my day-to-day decision-making and how my ethics and my worldview influence the way I do business, the way I manage people. There came a point after I had finished turning Citibank, it was not Citibank at the time, it was called Confia, but turning around those branches and handed them over to Citibank, that I had the opportunity to pursue a dream that I had had ever since I was in high school, which was to travel around the world. And I don't want to over-spiritualize this because the motivation was it was not at all a spiritual motivation, although God knew what he was doing. I just wanted to see the world. And I wanted to go see the most exotic, most difficult to reach places, the places I knew that once I was married, I would never be able to go to. And so let me go get this out of my system now, and I'll save Europe for when I have my honeymoon, you know? And so I planned a trip through East Africa and up the East African coast up to Egypt, and then around the Middle East for 3 months, and then across Asia all the way through Pakistan and India and all the way down to Southeast Asia. I traveled for 13 months. And got to see an amazing amount of countries and cultures, and it was an education to itself. But the greatest education that I had was as I traveled with my best friend, I also shared the gospel just like I always did. And let me just do a little parenthesis here. I sometimes meet people who say they want to go be missionaries and they want to go to some far-off country. And then I ask them, you know, tell me about your ministry now and who you're sharing the gospel with. And they just come up with a blank stare. And I was like, if you want to go do that on the other side of the world, you need to be doing it now, right in your context, because it's a lot easier where you are now than when you end up going on the other side of the world. But, you know, thankfully, I had a dad who had guided me and had discipled me. And so sharing my faith was just a natural part of who I am and who I was at that time. And so we would share the gospel as we traveled. And all of a sudden, I realized that people didn't have a context for what I was telling them. Because I thought I knew lostness because I worked around a lot of lost people at Citibank and at Procter & Gamble in Mexico. But it was different when I got to the Middle East. And people didn't understand what I meant by Jesus. They thought it was something else. And when I got to India, and people hadn't even heard what the sounds Jesus were. And I realized that, wait a sec, we can't find any churches to worship in. This is different. And I remembered what I had learned in church about the 10:40 window, and all of a sudden it made sense. And for you guys, I'm sure it makes sense. I was a little bit slower, and I just didn't get it till I saw it. But it made sense, and I was broken by it. One day I was in an airport in Pakistan, and I met this, I was sitting there in the, waiting for my flight to be called, and this they called out something, and I had, we had just come in from the Middle East, and so we had learned some Arabic, but now we were in a different country where they were speaking Urdu, and they made an announcement, and this guy came up to me, and he asked me in Arabic, he's like, is this a flight to Karachi? And I understood him because we had just been traveling, and I had gotten some travel words in Arabic, and I was like, no, this is not your flight. And he's like, I'm from Yemen, and I speak Arabic, and I don't understand what's going on. So he starts chatting with me, and I really, frankly, I don't know how we're having this conversation. I don't speak that much Arabic. He didn't speak English, but somehow we're communicating. And he's like, I thought you were Arab. And I said, no, I'm from Mexico. And he gets all excited. He's like, you're from Mexico? Are you Christian? And I said, well, yeah, I'm a Christian. He's like, let me tell you this story. 7 years ago, I had a dream, and this man, Jesus, appeared to me in my dream. And he told me, go find my holy book, because you will find truth in it. And I woke up from my dream, and I immediately started asking everyone for a Bible. And no one had one. But after a few days, the mullah, the religious leader, told me, you can't be asking about this, because we're Muslims, and you can't be asking about a Bible. And so I had to be more quiet about it. But all of my friends knew that I was looking for a Bible. And so after a while, one of my friends came and told me, you know what? I heard that in Pakistan there are Christians. He goes, so after a while, I had to save up some money, but I've saved up my money. I've been traveling all over Pakistan for the last 30 days looking for a Christian who will give me a Bible. I haven't been able to find one. But now I meet you. He's like, do you have a Bible for me? And I was like, of course I do. And I open up my Bible, my backpack, I pull out my NIV, and I give it to him. And he's all excited, and he looks at me, he's like, but this is in English. I was like, yeah, I mean, this is my Bible. This is what I read. And he's like, don't you have one in Arabic? I was like, no, I don't. And just then they called his flight. And I told him, you've got to go catch your flight. And he's like, but what am I supposed to do? I said, you just have to keep praying and asking God that he would send you his word. That's what lostness looks like in the 10:40 window, where for 7 years, you can be looking for a Bible, you can be looking for a Christian who will give you a Bible, and you can't find it. I came back from that trip determined that I would do something about this, and asking God to use me to reach people who have no access to the gospel. And so I came to the States, and I got some advice, and someone said, you know, you seem to have the business side figured out. Do you have the mission side figured out in business's mission? And I said, no, really, I don't. And so I came to Southeastern Seminary, got a Master's of Divinity, and then I moved overseas, and I went to Uzbekistan, worked for a nonprofit doing business consulting. But after a couple years, moved to Afghanistan, where I started a series of businesses that were real for-profit businesses that had the purpose of making a financial return, but that were what I was used to doing, which was being a light for the gospel wherever I was, and in this case, in a very dark place. So as we look at doing business for the gospel, or spreading the gospel on the wings of business, we've got to think, and I always get really suspicious when someone says, I've got this brand new methodology that's never been used before, and this is what is going to reach all the nations for Christ. And I sit there and go, really? I mean, after 2,000 years, you're coming up with something new? I get really suspicious about that. And is this just one more thing that you're going to hear about? And then there's this trend, and there's that trend, and we're just going to join the latest fad? And my answer to that is no. This is not the latest fad. This is how the church spread from the very beginning. Now, does it mean that the apostles didn't have a role? Of course not. They were the ones doing the equipping and the training of the saints. They were teaching the word to establish churches. But when you look at the major church planting centers, you look at Rome, Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem. Only Jerusalem was set up by apostles. The rest, Rome, Alexandria, and Antioch, were set up by traders and merchants and soldiers and regular church members who went out and were witnesses and won some of their neighbors to Christ. And then the apostles came in and they traveled in. And yes, Paul had a powerful impact in across Asia Minor and in over Greece and even to Rome. He had an amazing ministry, and he always sought to go to where the gospel had not been preached. But there was one Paul, and there were 5,000 people in the church of Jerusalem who went out. And that's the situation we're in right now. We now have, and I was with IMB for the Southern Baptist, so these are the numbers that I know. IMB has 5,000 missionaries out there on the field, and Southern Baptists are 16 million strong. Is that a proper engagement of the nations for the Great Commission? 5,000 out of 16 million? And yet every year we try to do fundraising, we try to give more to missions, and we all have this guilt trip because we haven't given enough. And we haven't stopped to think that our churches are full of people who can do this on a self-sustaining basis, that don't need to raise support. They can just go and cover their own expenses. And that is called business. And there is no reason why we cannot join arms with those who are going full-time and have raised support and work together on church planting teams. And we can do that in numbers much greater than those who raise support, not because they do a bad job at it, but because simply Americans give 2.2% to charity and evangelicals give 2.4%. And you know what? We can rant and rail against the church for not being generous, and we should. But then we can also say we're not going to rely only on the small pocket of donations. We can rely on the big pocket of investments and free enterprise and doing business for the Lord to advance the gospel. It wasn't just the church in Acts that did this. The Moravians, the greatest missionary movement to ever come out of an evangelical church. Highest percentage, 1 out of 60 Moravians went out as missionaries. Highest percentage ever that went out to spread the gospel. The only way that Count Zinzendorf and his group were able to afford to do this was because the missionaries, the vast majority of them, were self-sustaining business guys. And it was messy. And there were all kinds of conflict, because they would give credit out to the Eskimos and the Eskimos wouldn't pay them back, and then all of a sudden they'd have to, you know, be calling in accounts and wouldn't sell them stuff, and then Eskimos would riot. I mean, there were all kinds of problems. But you know, for 200 years, the Moravians have maintained self-sustaining missionary movements because they've done it through business. And so as we look at even our great hero of missions, William Carey, and we look at what he actually did, we realize that much of what he was able to do was achieved because he had a for-profit printing press, and he had translation, and he had a trading company, and he had all kinds of stuff that allowed him to do all the Bible translation and all the, you know, mobilized teams out there. Somehow, we have abandoned this model. We have innovated into a full support model where people have to raise their support from churches or where they have to go through some cooperative program, and we have abandoned the best practices method from the New Testament times, which says that it's not a full-time professional that is at the cutting edge. It's the regular church member, the guys like me who really don't know that much, but that are willing to be faithful in sharing our faith. These are the people who grow the church. And what we will see in Asia, as the church continues to expand in the 1040 window and in North Africa, is a movement to the Lord when your generation begins to be self-sustaining and we mobilize not 5,000, but 100,000. You guys, in a sense, are a blank slate. Not because you haven't achieved anything, but because you have years and years and years to develop the kind of experience and the kind of background that we need. You guys have Bible. You guys get a great Bible education here. You guys need to get real-world, practical business experience that's going to allow you to go and get jobs in these places. You need to, so get a job. Get a job now that pays your bills, and get a job when you graduate. Get a job that's a career, and don't be afraid that it's going to take you off your missions track. You know how you keep that focus when you're working 14-hour days, like sometimes you have to do when you're early in your career? You join a great church, and you join a great church that keeps you focused on the mission. And then don't be soft at work. Be the best worker out there. Excel in excellence in the marketplace and excel in excellence in holiness. That is how the gospel is going to advance in places where you can't have traditional missionaries. And finally, integrate your work and your ministry, just like I described to you. I didn't tell you a story about myself to exalt myself. I gave you a story about myself so that you can see what it looks like to have an integrated ministry and work life. Do that. If you do that here, you will be well equipped to do that overseas. And that's my challenge to you this morning. Thank you.
We hope you were blessed by this message. Additional audio messages and learning resources are available at www.ciu.edu/bookstore or call 803-807-5263. Messages are also available by podcast at iTunes. CIU is a regionally accredited biblical university offering undergraduate and graduate degree programs. Our purpose is to educate people from a biblical worldview to impact the nations with the message of Christ. Thank you for letting us minister to you today.